A few years ago, in 2003, I went to Edmonton, Alberta, to find out something I had wanted to know for a long time. My parents and I had come to the United States as refugees following World War II. And they had been friends with this couple in Canada. And they were like, they were double dated, they were married at the same time, and one couple emigrated to Canada, my parents emigrated to the United States. My parents, when I was very little, would tell us about the war. They would tell us about the fact that they missed their parents dearly. And they would start crying. And I know that we as kids, my brother and I, we would, you know, try to listen to our parents, but we saw them being very sad, and we didn't really want to hear what they had to say. We just didn't want to see mom crying. And when they got letters from Ukraine, from their parents and from their family, they would sit there and just shake at the when the postman came, because they always came registered mail, and they were there. I remember so well the postman coming, they had to sign for this letter. They'd be sitting there reading it, and crying and so forth, and we just didn't like that. The stories were very sad of a longing and a separation for their parents back in the Soviet Union. And usually I said, Mom, can I go outside and play ball? That was the way I usually responded to her. Both my parents were in the faith. They both came into the church. But my dad died when he was 42. I was a freshman at Ambassador College. And my mother died before her time at age 58, about 25 years ago, when we were living in Minnesota. My wife, Bev, cared for her last days at our home. And I never really got the full story. I had bits and pieces. I never sat down with my mom to really get the whole sequence of events that took place in chronological order. And I knew that the only people who knew the story in detail was this couple in Canada. And since they were getting to be 78 years old, I thought I better go sooner than later if I'm going to get the story. So I went up there with my camera and spent two sessions with them and taped about 3 hours of them talking about their experiences together, starting in Ukraine during World War II, working in a German slave camp during World War II, and their immigration to the free world. And what emerged was a story of tribulation, a story of great love, friendship, survival, courage, liberation, and triumph, and God's providential hand in their life. And it was a story that, after I heard it and wrote it down, I said, this has parallels with our spiritual life. And the fact that this group here is spiritual survivors, that whom God has called and has worked through, he saved them from certain obliteration and death. My parents were refugees who had gone through the tribulation and survived. My parents, when they heard about the prophecies of horrible things happening before the return of Christ and the talk that we've had about tribulation, would often say, hey, look, kids, we've been there. Those things that are prophesied and things that will happen to the world, we lived through it. And we were among the survivors. We were homeless for several years. I was born in a refugee camp, a United Nations refugee camp, in Hanover, Germany. We had no citizenship. We had no home. We had no documents. We were people that were refugees. I don't think we realize what a refugee is. Refugee has no status, no citizenship. He is nobody. He might have some internal papers in that camp, but as far as the world is concerned, he is nothing. I go through borders all the time with my American passport. I'm an American citizen right now, and I take for granted the fact that I am something. And you are something too when you have a citizenship. You are valued, you are respected, you have a standing. Just like the Apostle Paul used his Roman citizenship to get certain things done. If you don't have a citizenship, like many people in the world, as Palestinians, people in refugee camps in different countries around the world, you have zero standing and zero value and are nothing. We were homeless until we found a sponsor in the United States, and we were delivered to the Promised Land, which in this case was the United States. and we ultimately became naturalized citizens of the United States. The story today begins with Operation Barbarossa. This was Nazi Germany's attack on the USSR, one of the largest military operations of all time. On June 22, 1941, Operation Barbarossa began with over 3 million German soldiers opening a front more than 1,000 miles long with 3,300 tanks and 3 million soldiers crossing in blitzkrieg fashion. The initial blitzkrieg devastated city after city. Villages were burned. Major cities like Minsk and Kiev were bombed and quickly brought to submission. The Germans made quick headway with very little resistance. The Germans then forcefully, methodically deported millions of people to Germany to work in the factories and farms. The majority of Germany's labor force was now in the army. It wasn't just the 19, 20, 21-year-olds, it was the 30, 40, and 50-year-olds that served in the German army. It was huge, but it used every man of almost every age that was physically possible to do the work of the military. They fought a two-front war, a huge front with the Soviet Union, and a front with the West, and in Africa. I mean, they were all over the place. German men were in the army, and the women worked in the factories in the war effort. My mother, Nina, lived with her parents in a city called Lihachev, just 50 miles south of Kharkov, Ukraine's second largest city. And she and her close friend, Dusya, that's the wife of the man, this was the woman and the man that I visited in Canada, Walter and Dusya. My mother and Dusya lived in the same town, and they were taken by the same boxcar to Germany to work. And this was 1942 in June, 1 year after the start of Barbarossa. Both girls were 16 years old. Ironically, the safest place in Europe during World War II was Germany, because all the fighting and devastation and all the violence took place in the outer countries where the Germans extended. But Germany itself was a safe place. And it wasn't until the very end of the war where the Americans and the British started methodically carpet bombing German cities that these areas became dangerous. But that's where my mother and her friend Dusya and my dad and Walter lived. They worked in a work camp. It was not a concentration camp, it was a work camp. The Germans subdued the city of Lihachev, where my mother lived. Population of about 70,000, and the first air raid killed 700 people. My mother was herding a herd of cows, and she was bringing cows home from the field when the first bombs came, and she hid under the cows for security. And her fright that never left her, because she shook, and all the time that I knew my mother, she always had shaky hands, and that started when she was bombed the first time. As bombs fell around her and she had the cattle that she was bringing home. She never recovered from that initial attack, but that was only the first time that she would ever be bombed. The Germans, when they came, they told the teenagers that they would return home after 3 months. Of course, they really had no choice. What the Germans did was they came into a city, they came to the courthouse, and they got the records. And they sent a letter to every family to have their children of a certain age to report to the courthouse in 2 days. Germans put them on boxcars and they shipped them out. It was just that unceremonious. It happened both in my dad's case, who lived in Western Ukraine, and in my mother's case as well. Interestingly enough, for the teenagers, this was kind of an adventure. Hey, we get to go to Germany. We're going to a foreign land. It was like a service project. maybe that's stretching it a little bit far. But they were going to a foreign land. The Germans, of course, who had invaded, they knew that. But now they're going to go work there for a while. It's just part of what war is all about. Unfortunately, it wasn't for 3 months. It was 27 years before my mother would be able to see her mother again. The Germans took them to work in the city of Magdeburg, Germany, which is halfway between Berlin and Hanover, in what used to be East Germany and is now, of course, part of Germany, period. My mother worked in a shoe factory, and my dad worked in a factory that produced jam and jellies. But she maintained her close relationship with her friend, Dusia. My father had a similar story, as I mentioned. He was taken by the Germans from Western Ukraine. He was 17 years old, and he met his friend Walter when my dad, who played a mandolin, met him at a club in Germany. Not too many years ago, I think it was 2004, I visited my dad's village again, and I had my aunt and my cousin show me where my dad was put on a cart, where that cart took him down to the train station, and then where the train took him off to Europe. It was very, very interesting to see that. Conditions for foreign workers were very harsh. Strict controls were imposed on their movement after work and on weekends. And they had to wear a patch that had three letters on it, OST. In German, that means East, Ost. And they were known as Ostarbeiters, or the East workers. So basically like a slave outfit. They had some freedoms, but not very many. They were strictly controlled. They were not allowed to walk on the sidewalks. They had to walk in the street. Germany had a very strict caste system as to how they regarded people. The Germans regarded, with the greatest respect, Americans and the British. When Germans captured American paratroopers or British, they were put into proper detention camps, prisoner of war camps. They treated him very civilly. If a paratrooper was black, they shot him immediately. They had no regard at all for black people. The people from the east, like the Russians, Ukrainians, Slavic people to the east, they regarded them as kind of like a workforce. They had a lower respect for them and treated them like slave laborers. And that was the way that the German psyche was towards these people. We also know what they felt about the Jews. In spite of all these difficulties, my dad met my mom, and Walter met Dusia, and they double dated. And as difficult as conditions were, they maintained a friendship in that work camp. But I think one cannot understand the present-day Russian mindset without appreciating what the nation had gone through in the 20th century. It is mind-boggling when you think about just all it had gone through that has become part of the traumatized national psyche. The war between Germany and Russia was savage. It was unlike a normal war, if you can call a war normal. It was savage, brutal, and casualties for battles were measured in hundreds of thousands. They were just unbelievable. The Soviet Union had 15 million military deaths in World War II. Civilian casualties were another 15 million people. So 30 million people perished in World War II. They consider what we went through as a nation in World War II as a picnic. There was only Pearl Harbor. That was about it as far as any damage to our own country. And the half a million casualties or half a million deaths that we had in World War II in both Pacific and European theaters, we had 15 million people who died and 15 million civilians who died as well. Even the Germans marveled how little respect the Soviets had for human life and their own people. Just in the last 2 weeks of the war, Russia's final advance on Berlin, the Russians lost 2 million men because Stalin said, take it at all costs. And when the Germans made their final assault on Berlin, it was savage. They lost 2 million of their own men. And finally, when the Russians moved in on Berlin, they raped 1 million women. I mean, it was just absolutely barbaric beyond all description what had taken place. The ratio of men to women after the war was 100 women to every 60 men. That's what happened after World War II. I traveled with Dr. Hay to the Soviet Union in 1967. I was 19 years old, and I worked in the photography department in graphics, which is way different than things are right now with that field. And I spoke Ukrainian and Russian, so he asked if I'd come along to help him translate and take pictures for the Plain Truth. And we traveled for 7 weeks. And as we traveled to the Soviet Union, he marveled how few people there were of his own age, because he would have been at military age at the time of World War II. He says, I don't see anybody, hardly, of my own age. Everybody's either very old or very young, but not people of that particular age. Of those who went into the service in the Russian army at age 19, only 1 in 100 returned. So it's just a whole different ballgame as far as the way people view one another. So this contributes to a sense of we sacrificed, we fought this great patriotic war, and they looked upon themselves as the one who buried the brunt of World War II, which in one sense they did. The United States supplied them with equipment, with the merchant marine that took things up to Murmansk, they supplied them with tanks, with airplanes, but the Russians supplied the blood for that war. And so, therefore, the mindset of the people is traumatized. Russians treat their own people very badly, with great disrespect. I could go on and talk about that, you know, separately. But after they die, they treat them with the greatest respect. I have never seen so many war memorials where so much has been put into a war memorial. One of the most impressive ones is the one on top of Mamayev Hill in Stalingrad. It's a hill, it's a monument that's nearly 300 feet tall, 272 feet tall, of a woman with a sword. And below that, there are all kinds of rooms with names and so forth about the Battle of Stalingrad. A massive monument that pretty much covers the entire hill overlooking the Volga River. In Ukraine, there's another statue for the liberation of Russia. That's, again, just a very huge statue of the mother country. In Russia, the country is called a mother, and Rodina is the homeland and mother. And the mother is holding a shield in one hand and a sword in the other. This was for the liberation of Kiev. And on my last trip to Moscow, they just finished a war memorial to World War II to the goddess Nike, the goddess of victory. And that's right in the center of Moscow. But these statues and these memorials are almost obscenely huge and massive and show the greatest regard for people once they're dead. In Kharkov, we came across a cemetery on one of our trips with young people. We had taken YOU groups on three different occasions to Russia and Ukraine. And we found this military cemetery to be interesting as we saw the stones. Every stone represented 14,000 killed. 14,000 killed. I'd like to read just a few letters. After my mother died, she died about 25 years ago in our home. And among her personal items, I found a letter that she had been carrying over the years. It was dated June 7th, 1943. She had been in a German work camp now for a year, and she receives a letter from her brother, Victor, my uncle Victor. Greetings, dear Nina. In the first lines of our short letter, our family greets you. Nina, are you all right? You write that you are getting lonely, living on foreign soil, but you're not the only one separated from their family. Many people are finding themselves in this condition. Nina, we are not receiving your letters. In 1943, we have received only two postcards from you, one dated January 20th and the other dated February 8th, which we received in June. Nina, you are writing and ask about your brother Alex, who was in the military. We've not heard from him in 2 years. No. My uncles all returned on my mother's side from the war safely. On my dad's side, three of his brothers died. If we live, we will meet you again. The weather has not been good, or the weather has been good for growing, the gardens look good, and we will have things to eat in the winter. After the city was bombed by the Germans, people basically lived in root cellars for the next 3 winters. The Russians came in February, but the Germans came back in March. On the front where we are, there has been no shooting, but in May, many people in other neighboring villages died. The land is covered with blood, and the end of the war is not in sight. We're tired of the war. And my Uncle Victor, we had a family reunion in 1988, took us around the town and showed us where their old house used to be and where they lived in root cellars, and just showed us all around where everything was happening in their town. You said you'd like to see the flowers in the homeland again. That would be good, but the land has been ravaged by the war. I think often of your cheerful smile, your kind words to us, my loving sister. Mom and Dad and your sister Tanya work on the collective farm, but I work on the railroad. Please write to us about how you are eating and how are the Germans treating you. We have not been receiving your letters. Please give greetings to your friends with whom you are working. Then I received a letter after my mother died from my aunt Tanya, who lived in the Don River. She says, "My dear nephews and nieces, your mother had a hard life. In the years of the war, our village changed hands 6 times between the Russians and the Germans. The oldest and youngest were evacuated, but your mother, Nina, stayed behind where all the fighting took place. I still remember one moment when your mother was leading a cow home and was frightened, had a frightened look on her face after the Germans bombed our town. Then the Germans took our village and took Nina to Germany." And my father had a very similar story about things that had happened. Hundreds of thousands of people who had died. World War II claimed the life, they think, just estimates, it's not known how many people fully died in World War II, but approximately 100 million people perished in World War II. Now back in Germany, now back at the work camps, where my father, Walter, Nina and Dusia, the foursome, were friends and so forth, all of a sudden my father was arrested by the Gestapo and put into a concentration camp. No, from a work camp to a concentration camp. And this was very upsetting to the foursome because usually you didn't leave the concentration camp. They tried to go and try to find out what his sentence was and why he was there, but nobody would give them any answers. Walter tried to visit the camp and to see what was going on, but to no avail. He was never able to see his best friend, Igor. That was my dad's name. But he would see him in a column marching in one of the striped uniforms. And the job of these people in the concentration camp was to clear rubble and remove unexploded bombs after air raids. And they used people who were the Ostarbeiters, the East workers, because they were expendable. If a bomb blew up, well, that's just the way it goes. But these were the people who were used to go into the rubble and remove ordnance that had not yet exploded. And so Walter would see my dad in these columns at work. One afternoon, Walter saw my dad, waved at him knowingly, and threw him a piece of bread because he was starving and he looked awful. Any attempts to try to free him were futile. Months went by and there was nothing that could be done. But then one day a miracle occurred. Walter was walking on the street and he heard a voice behind him. "Walter, Walter, this is Igor." My dad had been separated from his work group and escaped and was hiding out. And when he saw Walter in the evening, he said, "It's me, Igor." And Walter looked at him. His face was all scratched up from all the work in the rubble. He was skin and bones. And he took him with him to a place where he had a friend who had an apartment to put him up there for a short time. After a brief hug, they decided, well, what are we going to do next? You can't stay with your friend. If the Germans find out that you're harboring a fugitive, it'll be bad. So Walter arranged with his friend to take my dad out to a farm, to smuggle him out, and to a farm where he could work. Now, the war was really coming to an end, and things were just a little bit more chaotic, and so they were able to do some of these things. So my dad left for Magdeburg to the country, where he got a job. There were no questions. Again, there was just so much disruption of the bombings, and the farmer was just glad to have somebody who would come and work for him. And actually, my dad was able to get some food and get them back to Walter and to the girls back at the work camp. But now, another phase of the war was coming. And this is the final assault by the Americans and the British on this area. Magdeburg was a city where there were a lot of oil dumps, and a lot of the fuel was stored in Magdeburg, and so it was a very strategic city for bombing. It was carpet bombed. All day long, the Americans bombed. All night long, the British bombed. And of course, it looks good in newsreels and so forth. What you don't know, though, is there are real people there. There are real people from all sides, and most of them are civilians who are taking the brunt of all this activity. The whole group, my mother, my Walter, and Dusia, would go into the bomb shelters. And they had these bunkers that people hid in. And they were underground, not too deep, but they were underground. And they were in a made in zigzag fashion. And the purpose of it was that people would get into each different section, and if there was a direct hit, which is quite often, only the people in that little section would be killed. But people in adjoining sections would survive. And so they spent a lot of time going into the bomb shelters, but there was a pecking order. The Germans were to go in first, and then another category of people, and finally the slave laborers were the last ones to go in, and sometimes there was no room for them. And actually, after several days and weeks of bombing, our group of four didn't even bother to go in. They were just watching the bombing like the fireworks. It was kind of a surreal experience. And if we get hit, we die. But in the meantime, they just watched it like we would go and watch the 4th of July fireworks, except it wasn't. It was a bombardment of the city of Magdeburg that kept on night after night after day after day. Also, as the Americans were advancing and bombing the bridges, the Germans would put these young workers, their ages. My mother came in at age 16. Now it's getting towards the end of the war. She's 19 years old. And they would put these young workers on bridges as human shields to deter the Americans and the British from bombing them, but the British and Americans bombed those bridges anyway. Our guys were able to whisk the women away and take them out to the farm where they weren't harmed. And so now we have at the farm the foursome. My mom and dad, they weren't married yet, they were married after the war, and Walter and Dusia. The farmer had no questions. It was very, very clear that the war was about over, and everybody was just saying, come on, let's just get this thing over with. The Americans came, and they occupied Magdeburg. Everybody felt absolutely relieved. What a joy. Relief. Freedom at last. Liberation. The interesting thing happened, though, is the Americans came to Magdeburg, and my dad was out at that farm. Let's go ahead now and jump ahead to 1966. My father came into the church, and he joined Spokesman's Club, like we all were part of Spokesman's Club. And one of the members was a good friend of ours, good family in the church in Minneapolis, Frank Muehlbauer. And my father got to know him and his wife, Bernice, and wonderful kids. And they had him over for dinner. And my dad is going through his story about how they were in Magdeburg, Germany, the war, and how my dad was on a farm. Frank Muehlbauer was a sniper in the U.S. Army. And my dad was an artist, painter, and he painted a lot of pictures. And he would paint a lot of little small sketches, and then later on, in the United States, he recreated them into big, bigger pictures. And one of the pictures was of the farm that he was on. He had a picture of his farm on the wall and told him, this is the farm that I was on. In fact, Gilbar looks at that farm and says, you know something, that looks awfully familiar. Very, very familiar. And so they began to coordinate where they were. Frank said, yeah, I was a sniper, and my job was to watch this specific farm for 3 days. And he said, you know something? I had this one young guy in my sights for 3 days. And the two of them determined that that was my dad. And here is Frank Muehlbauer, a sniper who's got my dad in his sights for 3 days, waiting for something or, you know, being on guard for something, you know, untoward to happen. Could have shot him any time. And they determined that that's how they first met. Now they were in Spokesman's Club together. It's truly an amazing story. It really is an amazing story about how God brings people together. Anyway, everybody's rejoicing. The Americans roll in with their Jeeps, cigarettes, hams, chocolate, you know, just the American way, you know, just the way it is in the movies. My mom and dad said that's the way it was. The Americans kind of roll in, and there's freedom. They're all laughing, rejoicing at the end of the war. My parents say, finally, it's over. But then, 2 days later, they wake up in the morning, and they don't hear the English language anymore. In fact, they hear the Russian language being spoken, saying, what's going on? They step out, and the Russian army now has moved into Magdeburg. What had happened is that, according to an agreement made between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin in Potsdam, I think Truman was involved as well, they made an agreement of how Europe would be divided, no matter what advances were made by the armies. And we determined that the city of Magdeburg would be part of the Russian zone. And so even though the Americans had moved into Magdeburg and beyond towards Berlin, they retreated and gave that whole area to the Russians. Things changed and got bad very, very quickly. The Russians treated these young workers, these Ostarbeiters, these teenagers, like traitors, collaborators, and subversives. They interrogated them incessantly. They were herded into trucks and sent to transition camps, where living conditions were unbearable and interrogation was incessant. They were trying to figure out how to take all the men and put them back into the Russian service, because after all this, now the Russians were declaring war on Japan, and they needed to have more men being shipped to the Far East to fight the Japanese. My dad was 21. The foursome was in one of these detention camps or transition camps, and my dad volunteered to care for horses for the Red Army. And he had a pass to go out. He said, we've got to escape. We've got to get out of here. And so my dad actually was able to go all the way to the British border, 50 miles to the west, and talk to guards at the border. It was a very cheeky, it was a very courageous step. But he said, is there any way that you can get a foursome across the border? Somehow he befriended, or somehow he was able to gain the confidence of one of the border guards. The guard said, yeah. He says, you come here, and you bring me a bottle of vodka, a suit, and a watch, and I'll let you cross the border. That was the cost of freedom. He needed three things, because he had to bribe somebody, the next guard to his right, the next guard to his right, to his left. That had to be done. The foursome had no idea if they'd be betrayed, if they'd change their mind, if there was anything. I mean, they were just completely going on what they had to do. And from the transition camp, they were able to walk out, because it had quite loose security, and they actually escaped from the transition camp. But they found themselves still on the east side of the Elbe River. And they had to get across this major river. It wasn't something that you could easily swim. All the bridges were bombed out, but the Army Corps of Engineers had built bridges, pontoon bridges across that river. And security was very, very strict across the bridge. So they decided, well, we'll have the girls walk across first, like nothing's happening, and then the guys will come later. And so the girls walked arm in arm, and the guards let them cross. They crossed the bridge. And they sat on the bank and wanted to see what's going to happen now with the guys. The guys came, my dad and his friend Walter, and the guards stopped them and turned them back. Said, no, you can't cross. The girls are watching this on the other bank. And they're just watching these guys and what's happening. So Walter and my dad were able to talk to a German fellow that had a coal truck, coal wagon, and they hid themselves in the coal and covered it up and got across. And they reunited with the young ladies. Again, these are people 19, 20, and 21 years old, kids. And they got on a train and headed for the border to cross at midnight. They had no money, they had nothing. They basically had the clothes on their backs and just what they could just have in their hands. They got to the border, and my dad met with a guard, and he presented him the vodka, the suit, and the watch. And right at the changing of the guard turned his back, and the foursome ran across the border. Other guards began to hear the rustling and the noise and started shooting. They started shooting in their direction. But the foursome ran and ran and ran and ran. They said they ran probably 2-3 miles into the British zone. And they finally figured out, I guess we must be alive, so we must be safe. And the foursome, all four of them, made it across. On the train that took them to the border, they found a purse that had enough money for them to get another train to Hanover, where they knew the United Nations was setting up a refugee camp. And so they got to Hanover. The day they got there, they said it was an interesting bit of news, because that day, the Americans dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and that was the big news of the day. The camp was still very rough in getting started. Mostly it was just bombed out houses. That's all it was. And the directors of the camp pointed to my dad and Walter and said, look, you want a place to stay? You know, you want to have a place? Here's a building, all bombed out. If you can, you know, fix it up and put a roof on it, you know, this is where you can live. And that's where my mom and dad lived for 4 years. They were married in 1946, and I was born in 1947 as a refugee. Walter and his wife, Walter was married too, had an uncle in Canada, and they asked a Canadian soldier going back to Canada if he could put a personal ad in the Alberta newspaper and just say, dear uncle, you know, so-and-so, this is Walter, your nephew. I'm in a refugee camp. Can you sponsor me to Canada? Or would you believe that his uncle saw that and sponsored him to Canada? So Walter got out there and his wife very, very quickly, within a year. My mom and dad had to wait four. They were hoping that Walter would sponsor. In a refugee situation, you cannot just decide that, hey, I think I want to go to Australia, or I want to go to South America, or I want to go to the United States. You had to have a sponsor. You had to have somebody who would vouch for you and guarantee that you would not be a burden on the state, and that the first 6 months of your coming to the country that you would support yourself. And so Walter did have such a person in Canada. My parents didn't know anyone. And they searched, and they searched. They were hoping something maybe in Australia would turn up, or Brazil. A number of their friends went to Brazil. But finally, close to 1949, my parents, through a knowledgeable person or through an acquaintance that my father's father, my grandfather, had with somebody in the United States, a Professor Gronowski from the University of Minnesota, My parents made contact with him and asked him if he would sponsor them, if he would vouch for them and sponsor them to the United States. Dr. Gronowski said yes. And my parents came over on a troop ship in 1949, July, and came to Ellis Island, and from there to Minnesota, where my mom and dad worked at an apple orchard. Then they moved to Minneapolis, St. Paul, which is what I consider to be my home. I grew up speaking Ukrainian as my first language. I didn't know English until I was 5. And my parents then became naturalized citizens. That was the next step. My parents were very diligent. And believe me, the standards for becoming an American citizen were quite high. They're higher than they were now, for certain. My dad had to study for over a year about how the American government was organized. He had to explain the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. He had to know who the senators were from the state of Minnesota. He had to know English. And when he had reported, or when he applied for American citizenship as an alien, he had to know all these things. And they turned people away and said, look, you don't know English good enough. Or you don't understand how the American government and American, you know, what our form of government is. You don't qualify to be a citizen of this great country. I remember my dad studying English, my mom and dad speaking their very broken English at home, but they learned it, and they both became citizens. They had to know who George Washington was. They had to know who Abraham Lincoln was. They had to know about Dwight Eisenhower, who was the president of that time. My parents ultimately came into the church in 1966. Now, when they first assembled in Minnesota, there were about 80 to 100 people that came over in this, what was called the New Immigration. It's all these survivors. And they represented only the tip of an iceberg of many who had died. My parents just gave me listing after people, person after acquaintance that died day after day in the bombings at the very end of the war. But these people formed a church. My dad was a trustee of the church, had a lot to do with organization of it. He was not a minister, but he was an organizer of this church. And these people really stuck together. They were like survivors. They all had the same story to tell, and they stuck together. They helped each other. It was just an amazing environment that I grew up in, of seeing this type of support for one another. Of course, other issues like language and culture and being in a strange land drove them one to another. My mother, both my parents, had not had any religion before. The Soviet Union was communist and atheistic. My mother never really adopted the Orthodox Church, but when she was on the troop ship, she saw a flash of a white building, kind of flashed different times. Maybe this is a strange story, but she vouches for this story. A white building. She never thought anything of it. And then when they were part of that church, she was, you know, a good member of the Orthodox Church. She was a servant and worked with the women's groups and so forth, but she never adopted the faith. But my parents were greatly beloved and very, very active in the organization of that church. In 1965, we began listening to the World Tomorrow radio program, and I started attending church. My parents were not very happy with that, but my mother always was very interested in what I learned at church or what I read in the Plain Truth magazine or what I studied in the Bible study course, correspondence course. She was very interested. My mother and I would talk for hours about our beliefs. My brother came along as well, and he studied. And we were just very, very fascinated by this. The article that kind of turned things, that made us really question a lot of things, was Christmas was observed 2,000 years before Christ. And I thought, well, how could that be? That just doesn't make sense. And it was a series of programs that showed how Christmas was a pagan holiday. I said, why are we keeping it? Then it was another series of programs about the Sabbath. Now, why are you worshiping Sunday when it says, remember the Sabbath? And I was very active in my church as a teenager at that time. And I'd go to my priest, who was really a good guy, and I would say, look, I just really want to know, why are we keeping Sunday? And he gave the kinds of answers that, you know, Sunday-keeping ministers normally do. Well, it was changed, Christ was resurrected, you know, Paul had to meet with the Jews on the Sabbath because that was their day. You know, all these reasons that just didn't add up and just didn't satisfy. Came to a point where my mom and dad could no longer continue in that church. My mother, when she read Herbert Armstrong's autobiography and studied and prayed and really looked into things very, very closely, saw a building that Mr. Armstrong would preach in, this white building in Oregon. She says, you know something, that's exactly what I saw when I was on the ship. Somehow, it was just like a reaffirmation of the fact that there was something in that, if you want to call it vision or whatever, I use that word very carefully, that she saw of what made her feel affirmed for her beliefs. And when my parents left that community, it was a shock. In fact, when my mother died in 1984, she still had a lot of compassion and feeling towards her friends in the former church. And she said that she wanted a letter read at her funeral about her beliefs, because a lot of her friends, in fact, it was a huge funeral, a lot of her friends came to the funeral from the Orthodox Church. They were still upset and couldn't understand why my mother left. My mother wrote a letter to them which was entitled, I Have Found the Pearl of Great Price. She said, I know that there are some of you here at this funeral who wonder about what I believed and what I did. I want to let you know that I thought no less of you when I made my decision, but I have found the pearl of great price. And she wanted all these people to know that what she found was something precious and wonderful and long-lasting. There are a number of parallels into our physical, spiritual, or the spiritual and physical of this story. I mean, when I got this whole story together finally, and I'm so glad I did. I'm so glad we took the time and took the trip to Canada to pull all this together. But the Apostle Paul, in Acts chapter 14, in verse 22, verse 21, says, when they had preached the gospel in that city and made many disciples, they returned to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, exhorting them to continue in the faith and saying, we must, through many tribulations, enter into the kingdom of God. If you thought it was going to be an easy trip, a gravy train of baptism, euphoria, and it's going to be just an easy ride to the kingdom, forget it. It's been a difficult ride. From the standpoint of physical difficulties that we suffer, spiritual invasions in our life, what had happened in the church in 1995, and other periods as well. We're told to endure in Matthew 24. He who endures to the end shall be saved. You use the word endure, you don't talk about something that is a pleasant experience. If you love football, if you love going to see the Cowboys, you don't endure a game, unless, you know, some of the games you endure, but you know, you don't endure these types of experiences. We don't want people to endure the boot scoot tonight. But we're told as Christians that we're to endure until the end, going through some extremely unpleasant situations. And what my parents had to endure, and when they were told that our nation must go through a great tribulation, they said, you know, kids, we have been there. We know what a tribulation is. We've experienced the tribulation. In Romans chapter 8, in verse 22, Paul writes, for we know that the whole creation groans and labors with birth pangs, together until now. Not only that, but we also who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves, groan within ourselves, eagerly waiting for the adoption, the redemption of the body. You know, there are times There are times in this past year where I have felt absolutely miserable, groaning, issues dealing with people, with spiritual battles. But that's what we've been promised. Through much tribulation, we will enter into the kingdom of God. He who endures to the end. The message is, don't give up. There's one thing about our parents, that they had the survivalist mentality through the entire process. They never gave up. If they needed to escape, they planned an escape. If they needed to make a move, they made a move. If they needed to resettle, they resettled. And I always admired them for the steps they took. Now, they could have been killed, they could have been rubbed out at any time. And I'm sure there were other people among those who died that also had those qualities. But definitely for survival, you've got to be one who doesn't quit and endures and goes forward, sees the promises, and seizes the promises as well. Another lesson in this whole thing is that our citizenship is in heaven. Our most important document, passport, citizenship paper, is not the one of being an American citizen, even though I highly value that and treasure that document, my citizenship papers. And I remember when I got it. I was in second grade. I was taken down to the courthouse downtown when my parents got their citizenship. I, too, pledged allegiance to the United States, truly a great country. But, you know, I pledge even greater allegiance to the kingdom of God, because that is my country. In Philippians chapter 3 and verse 20, our citizenship is in heaven, from heaven, of heaven. Our politics, our community is the heavenly community, the kingdom of God. You know, before we become citizens of the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven, we are nothing. Just like the refugees, still, whether they be Palestinians, whether they be Asians, or whether they be in Darfur, people who are homeless, without a home, herded together for the politicians and for the government to decide what are we going to do with this group of people. We were nothing. We were like refugees. Honestly, we were. We were refugees. Now we have been given citizenship. But in order to have citizenship, you have got to know what that kingdom is all about, how it's set up, how it's organized, what are its laws, its values, its language, its leaders. We've got to know these things. When my parents became citizens of the United States, they had to know these things. How much more do we have to know things that relate to even greater values of the gospel of the kingdom of God? How thankful are we for being members of that kingdom? And how much do we appreciate being survivalists? You know, you came here because God the Father called you. Christ said, no man can come to me unless the Father draws him. You were all drawn. You were all drawn from people who were dying, who were being bombed by Satan, people who were bombed by the world, people who were bombed by hopelessness. We have been given hope. And we have been given a way out. We have become survivors. And how thankful are we for that? I remember my priest, in his sermons, would talk to this group of people time after time, saying, let's be thankful that we were just like, that God just took a little shovel full of us from Europe and just threw us across the ocean and replanted us in the United States. I thought, how much more can we say that? God has taken us, a shovel full of us from the world, and replanted us into a living kingdom. That'll be something that will be lasting forever. Another lesson. The refugees could not move to any country unless they had a sponsor. We cannot go anywhere unless we have a sponsor. Unless we have somebody who will stand behind us, be our advocate. When my parents came to this country, they had to have a person who would stand behind them and guarantee that they would not be a drain on the state. Dr. Gronowski stood behind my parents. We have an advocate called Jesus Christ, who's our sponsor. He sponsors us to enter into the kingdom of God. He stands behind us. He's got to report to God the Father, too. He's got to say, you know, this guy's going to be okay. This guy's going to make it. This guy I'm standing behind. I believe in this person. We need a sponsor. We need Jesus Christ. He's the one who gets us across to that new nation, pays our ticket across. But there's one more thing that they had to find a way from. These are people who are totally homeless, no money at all. And they had to find a way across the ocean. Sponsor helps them. Sponsor gets them there. Jesus Christ gets us across the great divide to God's kingdom. Next, my parents, when they came to this country, became sponsors themselves. I remember my parents, when they came to this country, they were so grateful to be in the United States that they sponsored more of their friends from Germany to come to the United States. They stood behind them. You know, as we come to become citizens of this new kingdom, what about the people left behind? Do we have any concern about getting a message out to them? Do we have any concern about preaching to them? Do we have any desire to consider them? We should. I have sponsored one person in the United States. That was just about 4 years ago, one of the Sabbatarians. It was interesting what I had to go through. I had to submit to the State Department my last 3 years of tax returns. I had to report my income. I had to report what kind of work I did. My employment had to be verified. I had to show that when I was bringing a family over from Ukraine, that I indeed would stand behind them. And I was told that, you know, if they broke a leg, you know, that I would have to be there. I know my wife was a little bit concerned about some of this. But I know that how many people have helped us, and I had this feeling for this family that I really trusted, very fine family, that came to the United States. But we need to get the feeling, too, that, hey, we didn't just make it. What about the people behind us? And that's what evangelism is. That's what preaching the gospel is. That's what that concern is to reach out and find out who's still out there. Of course, there's a lot of people, and there's a lot of people being working, but we have to take personal responsibility for that. And there's different ways. Supporting a work that does that. To be happy to talk about our own citizenship, of who we are, about our salvation, and about our survival. Next, the immigrants stuck together and they watched out for one another. When they came together, they formed a church, they socialized. Sunday we had potlucks every week because everybody just wanted to be together. Like a survivor's club. We made it. We survived. And they were thankful for one another and they supported one another. Is that the way we still feel about the person sitting next to you? The person next to you is a fellow survivor spiritually. Do you regard them in that way? You know, with all my parents have gone through, I have a new appreciation for people who are left behind and refugees. And perhaps that's why I have some of the feelings I do for helping people. Because I know they're helpless, and if I don't do something, well, nothing will ever be done. And I can't save everybody, but I can help, some. Whether you talk about it in a spiritual sense or a physical sense, that sense of responsibility has to be there. We have to treat one another in the church with the greatest respect. That your survivability is because God called you, and the person next to you's survivability is because God called them. It's called us to salvation at this time. We need to treat each other with the deepest respect as co-survivors. This is a survivor's club. The church is a survivor's club of citizens, people who have a special passport and a special certificate of citizenship. Why I value that certificate that I have of my citizenship when I was in second grade. I remember when I got that certificate, I came to my second grade class, the principal came down and the teacher, and they had a little party for me. They said, now you're an American. Now you're a citizen of this great country. And I felt proud of that. How much more should we feel proud, pleased, rejoicing over the fact that we have been citizens of a great country? We are escapees, as Paul describes the book of Hebrews, those who have escaped the tribulations. We truly have escaped. The people around us in our society have not escaped. They're the people who are still being bombed. They're people who are failing. I pray that God will save some of them as well, that he won't allow them to fail, that he won't allow them to stumble, but he will save them as well. Well, this certainly was an experience that impacted me very, very deeply. As a young person, I didn't even pay attention to it. Even many years after my parents were in the church, my mother in particular, I never really got the whole story. But it was well worth getting the whole story about what all happened from being teenagers, from being yanked out of their homeland, being refugees, and surviving a traumatic tribulation and coming to become citizens of a new country and a new kingdom as well. Had a very, very touching and heartwarming lesson. And I want to share that with you today.